Good afternoon. As Abby said, my name is Beth Mayer, and I'm the program coordinator for the Colorado Book Awards at the Colorado Communities and Center for Book. So I'd like to thank Book Bar, as always, for providing such a great space for our finalist reading series. And this is the third reading series that we've had this season, so we're really glad to have all you here to continue the momentum of the reading series. I appreciate this opportunity to introduce you to six talented writers whose books have been named by an army of volunteer Colorado Book Awards selectors as the finalists in the juvenile and the young adult literature categories. The juvenile literature category will start, and that's another name for middle grade or, you know, sort of those middle years fiction, and that will be followed by young adult fiction. We're going to move quickly, and we'll keep everyone to their 5 to 7 minute time limits. We hope you'll enjoy Book Bar's great snacks and drinks, including a Shirley Temple special. And we've also made some, as Abby said, some pizza bites available over there that are complimentary, so help yourself. There'll be a Q&A with each author after they read, after he or she reads, and there'll be another chance for questions at the end. And feel free to ask anything you like from, you know, how'd you get the idea, or when did you start writing, or what your writing process is, or questions about the characters, or follow-up books. So really anything goes as far as the questions go. And all the copies of or copies of all the finalist books are over on that lovely book table available for purchase, and I'm sure all the authors would be happy to sign them if you would like. Our first reader tonight is Avi. Avi is the author of more than 70 books for children and young adults, including the 2003 Newbery Medal winner, Crispin, The Cross of Lead. He has won 2 Newbery Honors and other awards for fiction. He lives with his wife in Clark, Colorado. I'll just read a little bit about the book, and then he'll come up and read a selection for you. Of all my tasks, the most important was cooking mutton. Before an open fire, I had to slather the mutton with butter, dredge the chunks with salt and flour, spear them on a spit, and constantly turn that spit so as to roast the meat. While spinning the spit, I had to catch hot fat in the dripping pan, baste the mutton with those sizzling sauces, and know the moment it would melt, to be sure not in my mouth, but my master's. I don't know how long I was turning the spit when I noticed that the friar, the very same Dominican priest who was at the interlude staring after me, was now standing in the smoky haze at the bottom of our steps. He stood there and studied me for a long time, for long, gaping moments. This time, however, as if making up his mind, he drew close, leaned in, and whispered, "Boy, I know who you really are." Welcome, Avi.
I need the book.
I'm told there are some writers who memorize their books. I don't. Thank you. Thank you for being here. What can I tell you about this book, The Player King? This is a true story, and in which there are no characters in the book who do not appear in history. But the fact of the matter is, the principal character, a boy who has a very odd name, Lemuel Samuel, this is 15th century. Nobody knows who he was or where he came from. They think they know what happens to him, and that's part of the story. But he comes to light after Henry the VII, who was then King of England, comes to the crown because he has defeated Richard III on Boswell Field. But when Henry takes the throne, there are other young people who have, by the rules of monarchy, a claim to the throne. Perhaps some of you have heard of the princes in the tower who disappeared. But there was another one, the Earl of Warwick. And no one knew where he was. And then this boy appears in Oxford, England, and he's pronounced the Earl of Oxford and the real King of England. And what happens to him and how this happens is, as I say, a true story, except nobody knows what happened. But this boy, if you read the book, you'll find that he was crowned King of England in Christ Church, Dublin, was given an army of 10,000 to invade England. And no one knows why, but it happened. So let me see where I can find a place to read. So when the book begins, we are introduced to Lemuel, who's working in a tavern, Tapley's Tavern. Which still exists in Oxford, England. Late at night, the same day, and outside, a steady rain was bucketing, the water trickling down our stone steps and seeping over the floor, turning it into mud. Candles were all but gutted, so only little light lingered. In the tavern's dullest corners, a few cup-shop men slumbered. Though my yawns were bigger than my head, I was still at cleaning chores when the black friar came down the steps. The reference to black friar is to the kind of robes they wore. The Benedictine order had black robes, so they were known as black friars. His bald pate was glistening wet, his black cloak dripped. In the demi-darkness, his face seemed as white as a ghost. A manservant was with him, holding up a flaming torch. When the brother reached the bottom, he paused and looked about, only to fasten his eyes on me. Though unhappy to see him, I acted as if I didn't notice. All the same, he approached and said, "Where's your master?" "Back room, I think, brother. Fetch him." When I hesitated, the friar said, "Do as you're told." Reluctantly, uneasy he was there, I went to my master's back room, a small, ill-lit place, stinking of sweat and dregs. It had a wide straw-stuffed bed and an old cleft table upon which a burning candle was stuck in a pool of gray wax. On the floor was Tapley's iron-strapped money chest. It was open. My master sat at the table, his wife across, and before him lay the day's earnings, a meek mound of farthings, groats, and pennies. Beneath Mistress Tackley's greedy gaze, the tavern keeper was tallying the coins with his fat, dirty fingers. "Master," I whispered, "that black friar is back." Tackley stopped counting. "What does he want?" "You." Master and mistress eyed one another. If they said anything, I didn't hear. The next moment, Tackley, with a grunt, heaved himself up from the table. When he stepped to the door, I started to follow. He shoved me back. "Stay here and make sure she doesn't steal anything." He pointed to his wife and went out. Moments later, Tackley returned with a leather pouch. He pitched it onto the table where it landed with a clink, the unmistakable sound of coins. His wife glanced up. "He purchased the boy," Tackley announced to her. Only then did he turn to me. "Go to the friar, he's your new master." "Sir?" I gasped, not sure if I heard correctly. "Are you deaf, boy? The priest bought you, you're his." I stood there, astonished. "Go!" cried Tackley. I was too frightened to move. "Didn't you hear?" Tackley bellowed. "You belong to him. Leave!" Did you know he was coming back for me?" I asked. "Out!" shouted Tackley. Speechless, confused, unable to grasp how my life could wrinkle so quickly, I remained in place until Tackley raised a fist, ready to strike. Unwillingly, I crept back to the main room, The black friar stood there looking down at me as if to assay his purchase. The manservant was on the steps. Trembling, I peeked up, my head a tumble with questions. What's going to happen? I've never been anywhere else. How can I leave Tackley's? How will the priest use me? Come along. I looked to see if I could run away, but the manservant blocked the only escape. I glanced back. Master Tackley stood watching. I gave him a pleading look. He ignored it. Full of dread, but having no choice, I followed the friar out of the tavern. And that's almost where it begins, and you find out what happens to him and what doesn't happen to him. So, there you go. The title is slightly wrong. I wished, as so often happens, after you publish the book, you think of all the good changes you can make. It should be the player kings, plural. But there it was, done. Have any of you any questions about this or anything? Yeah.
How old were you when you were first published?
30. Are you asking me how old I am? But I know people. Mary Shelley was 19 when Frankenstein was published. What's her name? Who wrote? Anyway, there are lots of books published by teenagers, but I was not one of them. So, by no stretch. So. Is that, why is that relevant to you? Is it, I mean, do you still have time? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, I'm still a teenager, so I'm just like gauging how old I'm going to be by the time I publish my first book.
The honest answer, it doesn't matter. It's when you write your first good book, is the answer. And Bessie Hinton, I was 15 when she wrote, what was the title of her book? The Outsiders. That's not bad.
No.
And do you know why she wrote it?
Because
her English teacher said, you can't write. So she went home and wrote The Outsiders. Not bad. And you look older than 15, right?
Yeah.
So you're a little late. So, I hate to put pressure on you, but you got lots of time. Anything else, Adam? When are you going to write your first book? Or have you written it? You're not a big writer? Oh, math girl, that's cool. My wife is a math girl. She's good at that. Yes, yes.
With 70 books, I'm very curious, has your writing process changed, evolved, and in what way?
I think not for me, but for many writers, the introduction of the computer has made a big difference in writing. I think you'll find that books are longer than they were a generation ago. And I have no doubt that's in part because of the computer, because writing is, particularly if you use a manual typewriter, as I used to use, it's physically very exhausting work. And the computer makes the writing much easier, the physical part of it. So my books have gotten longer. They're spelled more correctly. That's key. And I don't know. I think what I like to say for myself, having success, and I'm a successful writer, it gives me more patience for my failures, because you just work hard and harder. And the only thing I would say is I find writing gets harder all the time, not easier. I hate to tell you that. The first book is a snap. The 70th is hard.
How many rejection letters did you get before the first book was a snap?
I think about seven. Is that good or bad? That's good. Well, book sold only 10 copies. I don't know. It should have been maybe more. I don't know. Yeah?
Are your books available on CD, like in audio?
Most of them.
Are you the one that narrates them?
No. I've done a tiny bit. Reading from recording is extraordinarily strenuous, very demanding, and it takes a long, long time. And you have to be skilled at it, and I don't have those skills. So.
Very good delicate.
Well, yeah, I can read okay, but it's a big difference. I remember the first time I ever recorded a book, my own, and I was in a booth, and you have headsets, you're totally immersed in this, and I read 4 words, and the engineer said, "Stop. You mispronounced the second word." And then, okay, so I repeated it. "Stop. You left out a word. And this is my text." And so it went on for 5 hours. And by the time we had done, I had recorded 20 pages. So I swore never to do it again. And I haven't.
Are you involved in choosing who does read them?
I never was, and it depends on who the publisher, the recording company does. I've been working now with Candlewick Press, and they now, when the book is being recorded, they send me excerpts of 3 or 4 different people that they've are considering and ask me for my input. They don't ask me to select, but and perhaps give a reason or something like that. So, to that degree. It's the same with covers. I don't choose the covers. But they give me input. I mean, the last time I saw a new cover for a book unpublished, I wrote and said I didn't like it, and they wrote back and said, "Well, we do." That's the way it is. So, anything else I can tell you? Okay, thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Avi. Our next reader tonight is Todd Mitchell, who will read from his juvenile literature novel, The Last Panther. Todd is the author of a few other books for middle grade and teen readers, including The Traitor King, The Secret to Lying, and Backwards. Currently, he teaches creative writing in Fort Collins, where he lives with his wife and 2 wily daughters. When 11-year-old Kiri helps her scientist father capture the last known wild panther, her life in her Florida swamp becomes threatened by poachers, and she must embark on a dangerous journey to save both the panther and herself. Giant sea turtles, climate refugees, and mystical encounters with the shadow that hunts populate this fast-paced, heart-pounding tale.
Thank you. I want to thank you all for coming out here today on this beautiful day. It's so nice to see people. And I'm really honored to be in the presence of so many great writers. So thank you for organizing this event. Thank you, Book Bar, for hosting it, and for all that you do to support reading here. Also, happy Earth Day. This is a good book for Earth Day, because it's a book that I wrote with my 10-year-old daughter to explore some of the issues that she cares most about and that I care about. And some of those are environmental issues of species extinction and ecosystem collapse, as well as income inequality. And I'm excited because I just found out today that this book was selected as a Green Earth Honor Book. Let's give them for Earth Day. And I'm going to read a little bit. How's that sound? A little better? Thank you. Nancy's stuck behind microphones. So I'm going to read a little bit from further into this book, almost to the middle. So I need to tell you a few things that are going on at this point.
So Kiri is 11 and she lives in a swamp with her scientist father, and they capture one of the last known wild Florida panthers. This happens in a possible future Florida that's devastated by climate change and may look a bit different than the Florida that we know. And at this point, Kiri has fallen asleep next to the caged panther. And the panther was asleep too because it had been tranquilized. And Kiri has a pet rat named Snowflake. And I think that's pretty much all you need to know, except Kiri is kind of fading in and out of consciousness. She has cat scratch fever, which is an actual thing. And so she's been getting delirious as the story goes on. The thunder she'd heard in her nightmare rumbled again, louder this time. She turned her head to the side and saw two green eyes shining in the moonlight beside her. The panther was standing and growling. A jolt of fear surged through Kiri. She scrambled back, scooping Snowflake into her arms. He trembled and tried to burrow into her armpit. All her senses focused on the panther crouched in the cage, inches from where she'd been lying. The panther's fiery green eyes glinted in the moonlight, and her ears lay flat against her head in a threatening posture. The tranquilizers in the meat must have worn off. With every breath, the panther seemed to become more awake, and she was angry. "Shh," said Kiri. "I'm your friend, remember?" She reached a hand out toward the cage, hoping to calm the panther. The shadow within snarled and lunged, slamming into the walls of the cage. Kiri jerked her hand back. Her heart pounded, pushing fear through her veins. The panther growled again, all coiled muscle and bristling wildness seeking release. Kiri's neck prickled. Each growl reverberated deep in her chest, rattling her bones with the uncontainable rage of a mother separated from her cubs. Fear lashed through Kiri, strong as a hurricane, ripping her thoughts away. The Debbie marks on her shoulder and cheek burned, and her pulse raced. Still, she refused to back away from the growling panther. Then a curious thing happened. Her fear broke apart, and she discovered a calm beyond the fear. Sometimes, in the middle of a storm, the sky would clear and the wind would quiet for a short while before it picked up again. Her Da called it the eye of the hurricane. Kiri felt as if she were in that eye now. Her breathing deepened, her pulse slowed, and when she looked at the panther, she finally saw it clearly. It wasn't just one creature, but many. It was all the panthers that had come before it, and all that might come after. Puma Concolor, Catamount, Ghost Cat, Mountain Lion, Florida Panther, the Shadow that Hunts. The creature she saw was all of these and more. It was the spirit of wildness itself, and if it stayed in this cage, that spirit would be torn out, and the forest would unravel. So, Kiri comes to a decision to release the panther, and before she releases the panther, knowing that the panther is probably going to lunge at her and attack her, she says farewell to Snowflake and puts Snowflake up in a palm tree where she thinks he'll be safe, and it's going to pick up there. The panther's growls grew louder as Kiri approached the cage. She reached for the knife at her belt and held it out before her. The blade seemed such a small, insignificant thing. The panther had five blades, just as sharp on each of her paws, and jaws strong enough to snap Kiri's bones like twigs. She had eyes that could see in the dark and ears that could pinpoint mice moving through the grass a dozen steps away. She was many times stronger and faster than Kiri, and she could move in complete silence without being seen. She had no illusions about the panther anymore. She was a wild predator, and she'd tear through Kiri just as she'd tear through the walls of the cage if she could to get to her cubs. Still, Kiri approached. Taking a deep breath, Kiri slid the tip of her knife into the gap between the cage latch and the door. The panther's growls made her stomach quake. Once she did this, there'd be no turning back. She knew that. But she also knew that she couldn't live with not doing this. Using all her strength, Kiri pried the knife against the metal bars until the latch snapped and the cage door fell open. The panther huddled in the shadows at the back of the cage. Kiri closed her eyes, expecting death to come quickly now, a hot bite on her neck or a crushing paw swipe to her head. At least it would be better than withering from the fever and dying slowly. For a moment, all was quiet. The door stayed open, yet nothing happened. Swift as the wind, the panther leapt. Everything, even the blood flowing through Kiri's veins, stopped. But the hot bite didn't come. There was no crushing paw strike, no pain. Perhaps death happened faster than she imagined. She opened her eyes, expecting to see whatever the dead saw. The trees, grass, and ruins all looked the same as before. The cage door gaped open in front of her, but the cage appeared empty. The prowling shadow within had vanished. She scanned the forest, spotting the panther less than a stone's throw from where she crouched. Moonlight glinted off the panther's fiery green eyes as the creature studied her. "Follow," whispered a voice that sounded less like her mother and more like the hiss of a cat. And that's where we'll leave off. Thank you. So, yeah, if anybody has any questions, I'll be happy to...
Imagine if that title had been the last black...
I know, you know, it's so funny with, like, the Black Panther out. People have been saying, "Hey, congratulations for the Black Panther." Thanks. I wish I had.
More than the movie, I think.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Well, I was impressed by the movie, actually.
It's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes?
What are some tips you have to write a good query for this
movie? Okay, tips for a good query. You know, there's actually really good models online. But one of the things that I find useful to do, you know, for a query or not, just for the writing process, is to try and write a good log line for your book, like a one sentence, what is the book about? And I find this incredibly hard to do because, you know, it's like trying to summarize the forest while you're walking through it. So the more that you can refine it to that, like, really short pitch and get to what the heart of the book is, that's going to clarify your own understanding of the story, too. And usually I'll do this before I write a book and then afterwards, and they're always different. Because I try to write to discover, I try to write to explore what happens and who a character is. And so I always start with a question that I want to explore. With this book, that question, by the way, was, what is the species worth? You know, what would you do to save a species if you could? And what could a kid do? What could an 11-year-old girl do? And I was really inspired by my daughter here, who showed me how even the youngest of us can create significant lasting change. Yeah?
Talk a little bit about your experience with writing this with your daughter coming up with the idea.
Oh my gosh, it was the best writing experience of my life, getting it to write with my daughter. And I wrote my first middle grade novel, called The Traitor King. It was 10 years ago. I didn't mean to imitate. But I wrote that when my daughter was one, or finished it when my daughter was one. And I finished it like imagining, oh, someday she'll read this. And that was kind of a thrill, but it was nothing compared to the thrill of being able to write drafts of chapters and share them with her every night, and then get her feedback, and then revise the chapter with her. And she's the one who, for instance, said that Kiri needed a pet rat, and I needed to call that rat Snowflake. And so I added Snowflake in, saying, all right, we'll see what happened. And then Snowflake ended up being a really big character in the book and an important character. Anything else? Thank you all for being here.
Thanks so much, Todd. Our next readers are Sarah Miller and Pat Toole, who will read from their juvenile literature novel, Path of the Thunderbird, A Grand Canyon Adventure. Sarah is a fiction and nonfiction writer who penned her own column for a suburban Denver newspaper for over a decade. She currently is the development director for Dinosaur Ridge and lives in Evergreen with her husband and two sons. Pat is a former elementary and middle school teacher with a master's in education. A member of SCBWI, she lives in Evergreen with her husband and travels extensively in search of settings for her stories.
I forgot to read a little blurb about your book. Would you like me to sort of set you up in that way?
Sure, or okay. I can read it. Whatever you want to do, you read it.
That's great.
So, about the book, Nate, Kira, Hope, and Oz have planned their Grand Canyon adventure for months. Armed with maps, camping gear, and lots of food and water, the 12-year-olds are certain nothing can go wrong. But when they receive a mysterious letter from Nate's late grandfather, who once studied the elusive California condor, their carefully planned trip turns upside down. They suddenly find themselves on a treasure hunt through the Grand Canyon. As they hike from clue to clue, the adventurers must face stormy weather, wild animals, and dangerous terrain in their quest to make the discovery of a lifetime. From one rim to the other, they learn about the resilience of nature, the importance of friends and family, and the wonders waiting to be discovered within the Grand Canyon.
That was nice. Thank you for clapping for the cover on the back.
My name is Sarah.
And I'm Pat, and we're short.
We're very short. Here, we're going to adjust this a little.
How's that?
We are honored to be here. Thank you to BookBar for having us. Thank you to Colorado Humanities for supporting Colorado authors. We're so grateful for that. We feel like we are a very fitting team to follow Todd Mitchell. Pat's question to him was about how was it to write a story with your daughter. We happen to be mother and daughter. So when we were approached by the National Park Service to write this book, we had never co-written anything, let alone co-written with my mother, her daughter. So it was an adventure in and of itself, figuring out how to write with one another while telling the story of 12-year-olds hiking rim to rim in the Grand Canyon. To give you just a little bit of backstory, 2 years ago, Grand Canyon was looking for a middle grade book because there is an initiative in the U.S. called Every Kid in a Park. Every fourth grader in the United States gets a free parks pass to every national park during their fourth grade year in school. And Grand Canyon had unprecedented numbers of fourth graders who were coming to the national park. And they said, we have a lot of picture books, we have a lot of nonfiction books, but the National Park Service had never published a chapter book for young readers about their experiences in the Grand Canyon. So we were approached and asked to co-write the book, and that is how Path of the Thunderbird came into being. And we need to give you just a little bit of backstory because we're going to throw you into the midst of an action scene. But Beth mentioned that Nate, Kira, Hope, and Oz are our four characters. Nate is the storyteller here, and his cousin Kira is very interested in science. Their grandfather was an ornithologist who studied the condors, and Kira has taken it on. She is convinced that on this treasure hunt, they are looking for California condors, which were reintroduced into the Grand Canyon after having lived there 10,000 years before. That's not ultimately what they find, so I won't spoil it for you, but Kira has taken it upon herself to climb up a rocky cliff in looking for these caves. The only other thing that you probably need to know is that Oz, who will hopefully come to her rescue in this scene, is obsessed with Bear Grylls and Survivor Man, the shows on TV, the outdoor survivalists. Oz is a lazy kid who loves his technology and was sort of dragged tooth and nail into this adventure, but throughout the course of the story comes to discover how important some of the things that he has learned by watching Survivor Man and Bear Grylls really turn out to be. So that's what you're going to see here.
Kira paced and looked through her binoculars, her eyes glued to the battleship rock formation. Come sit in the shade, Kira. You're going to give yourself heat stroke, Graham said. I'm fine. Besides, I can't see as well over there. Kira lowered her binoculars to look at Gran, but raised them again quickly. What are you looking for? Obviously, condors, like you spend every minute of your day doing, but what specifically? Are you just willing one to fly up in the sky? Oz asked and passed me some Gatorade powder, which I poured into my water bottle. There is a cave up there. Actually, there are lots of caves up there. It's where the condors gave birth to their young 10,000 years ago. She swung her head from side to side. I thought the condors were introduced to Grand Canyon after they became endangered. I didn't know they lived here all along, I said. That's the point. They lived here in these rocks for thousands of years, and then they gradually started dying out. When the captive breeding and reintroduction program started in the 1980s, the only condors left were in California. They started breeding those and releasing them from Vermilion Cliffs every year. It's amazing that 10,000 years later, they still managed to find their way home. Kira fooled with the focus on her binoculars as if trying to get a clearer view of things. Hey, if you have a good cave, I say, why not move back in, even if you have to clear out some 10,000-year-old cobwebs, Oz said, and we all laughed. There, I knew it was there. That has to be it. That has to be what we're looking for. Kira bounced on her toes. I stood up beside her and she handed me the binoculars. What do you mean? I closed one eye and looked through the binoculars until I spotted the black hole that Kira pointed to on the side of the rock formation. We're on the right trail. If we're looking for a nest, there has to be one up there. I just know Grams wants us to find a baby condor. The tracking list on the Grand Canyon website listed numbers 187 and 280 as nesting up there this year. We need to climb, she said. I passed the binoculars to Oz, who looked up and gave them to Hope. Kira, the battleship has some very technical climbing, especially from this side. That route is 10 times harder and more dangerous than anything I climb. Gramps would never expect you to endanger yourself. That looks like a climb for an expert. We don't have the gear. Let's just stick to the trail. We must be looking for somewhere else, Gran said. Oz put his arm around Gran. Yeah, what she said. I vote for no climbing. Kira didn't seem to like what she heard. She ignored Gran and scrambled up the rocks at the bottom of the wall and climbed over a sloped area. What are you doing, Kira? I asked. She slid her hands up a flat, vertical section of rock and tucked her fingers into some cracks. She climbed like a monkey. Within seconds, she was higher than any of us could reach. Kira, come down from there right now, Gran used her bossy voice again. If I can just get over to that ledge, I'll be close to the caves. I just know it. Kira continued to climb. Kids, get under her, all of us. If she falls, she's going to break something. Kira Marie Wilder, climb down from there this instant. But my cousin seemed possessed. When she paused for a second, I thought she might have changed her mind, but she didn't. She eyed the rocks in front of her and found crevices for both of her hands and feet so she could boost herself up higher. There was no way we could reach her, even if Oz stood on my shoulders and Hope on his. Kira reached for another handhold but missed it. Kira, that ledge is too far. You're not going to make it or you're going to die trying. I held my hands up helplessly in the air, knowing that if she did fall, I'd never be able to catch her, maybe just break her fall.
The section of the wall on either side of her was sheer. She had run out of handholds. I moved up the loose gravel on the slope next to the base of the wall as quickly as I could. Now you too, Nate. Don't even think about it. Gran's voice cracked. I'm not climbing. I'm just getting under her. I held my hands high in the air. When I got directly beneath her, I could see Kira looking straight down between her legs at me. She had a determined look in her eyes. Kira made another leap at a rock that was just out of her grasp. She missed and teetered on one foot. Don't move. I tried to climb the rocks to reach her, but my foot slipped and my hand scraped down the rock face. Hey, don't. I glanced back at Gran. Oz was surrounded by the rope that he was always tied to his backpack. Hey, my fingers are so tired. I don't know how long I can hold on. I'm sorry. This was stupid. It's okay, Kira. We'll get you down. Although, I didn't know how. What are you doing, Oz? I asked when I turned around. He ignored me and called to Gran. She moved to his side while Hope and I continued to stand shoulder to shoulder with our arms stretched above our heads. Oz and Gran conferred before she took over and lashed the rope around a boulder. Kira, just hang on. I saw this on Wild Man, Oz said. Seriously, Oz, enough with the Wild Man. We don't have time for this. I couldn't believe he would joke when Kira was seriously in danger. This isn't nonsense. I'm not kidding around. Do you hear any outback accents coming from me? Gran is securing one end of the rope on the boulder because that will be our anchor. Oz then tied knots about a foot apart on the other end before he lashed the free end around a rock about the size of my fist. In all the years we've known each other, I've never seen him so focused. Kira groaned above me. Just hang in there. He's almost done, I said. Oz Oz ran over to where Hope and I stood. You're not going to like this part, Kira, but you have to trust me. I'm going to toss this rope up and over that ledge above your head. If it works, this rock will pull the rope down on the other side, and we can use the ledge to support your weight. Wait. Kira breathed in and out quickly and shifted her weight on the teetering outcroppings. Did you just say that you're tossing a rock at my head? Well, yeah, but it's a small one, and it should go over you. Just duck if it comes close to your face. Oz stepped back and flung the rope up into the air. He looked like Batman tossing a grappling hook onto a building. The rock missed the ledge and crashed down next to Kira. She screamed as one of her feet slipped off the rock when she ducked. We'll stop there. Questions from anybody?
What was the process like collaborating on this book?
It was fun. It was lots of fun. We found, because we were writing for the National Park Service, there was so much research that was involved, and she is the queen of research, and we had days I would sit and write, and I would text her, and I would say, okay, they're going to see this plant, and we have to get it exactly right, because the manuscript was reviewed by the National Park Service geologists and wildlife biologists and cultural liaisons, and so then we would switch, and she would write a scene and send it to me. We did a lot of back and forth. And
what was interesting was we only had 3 months to do it. Actually, it was less than 3 months. Because the National Park Service, the Grand Canyon, decided they wanted this book by June. We got the offer in March, and that was very interesting. So we wrote every day together in the same room, on the telephone, whatever. Other questions? Well, thank you very much.
Thank you all. Thank you so much. And I learned something, which is that you're a mother-daughter team. I didn't know that before. Our other readers tonight are going to be from the young adult literature category. Unfortunately, at the last minute, Len Lajos could not be here today, but in case anyone came especially to hear from his novel, I'll go ahead and read just a little bit of it. It's called Life in a Fishbowl. He's the author of The Scarborough Boys, of William C. Morrow's...
Could you move the mic to your mouth?
Oh, sorry.
Thank you.
I guess I am a little taller. Sure. Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. He's the author of Star Boys, a William C. Morris Award finalist and a number one Indie Next pick, and Scar Girl, the sequel. Len lives in Denver with his wife and 2 young sons, where he owns the Tattered Cover bookstore. When Jackie discovers that her father has been diagnosed with terminal brain tumor, her whole world starts to crumble. She can't imagine how she'll live without him. Then, in a desperate act to secure his family's future, Jackie's father does the unthinkable. He puts his life up for auction on eBay. Jackie can do nothing but watch and wait as an odd assortment of bidders, some with nefarious intentions, drive the price up higher. The fate of her entire family hangs in the balance. But no one can predict how the auction will finally end, or any of the very public fallout that ensues. He said, go ahead and start on page 3, so that's where I'll start. Let's see. Jackie Stone loved her father. She loved him a lot. She kept a photo of her dad, Jared, taped to the inside of her locker at school. It was a recent selfie of the two of them on a ski lift. Wisps of Jackie's blonde hair poked out from beneath her hat, but did nothing to obscure the smile stretching from one side of her face to the other. Whenever the day got rough, which for Jackie was more often than not, she would sneak a peek at that photo. It had become a kind of visual security blanket. On the days Jackie's father wasn't in Salem, where he served in the Oregon State Legislature, she would find him barricaded in his study. Jackie suspected he was just as likely playing games on his Wii as he was working. The joy her dad took in beating Tiger Woods at his own game, even on a virtual golf course, made her love him even more. Either way, she knew better than to interrupt her father when that door was closed. But Thursdays were different.
It was her father's day to run errands for the household, the grocery store, the post office, the dry cleaners, and then head to the gym. On returning home, he dropped his bag of sweaty workout clothes just inside the front door. Take the stairs two at a time and squeeze in next to Jackie on the top step. They would talk for a bit, eat a family dinner on the top step. Eat a family dinner with Jackie's mother and sister, and then snuggle on the couch and channel surf the TV. She and her dad called it father-daughter date night, and it was Jackie's favorite time of the week. Even at 15, curling into the warmth and safety of her father's shoulder gave Jackie a feeling of peace and comfort that she found nowhere else in the world. She knew he felt the same. But the wait for her father to come home on this Thursday was interminable. He was late. So now we're... Okay. Is it a bird? Or? Okay. So now it's switching POV to the, I think it's the father. Jared Stone liked his brain. He liked it a lot. Sure, there were times, the monotony of the evening commute, the late innings of a lopsided baseball game, the comforting repetition of the weekly church service, when it would seem to shut down, switch to some kind of autopilot. But for the most part, Jared's brain was hard at work. It helped him navigate the halls of the state capitol, where he was serving his fourth two-year term representing the good people of Portland. It told him how to read the inscrutable faces of his wife, Deidre, and his two teenage daughters, Jackie and Megan. To know when they needed him or when he should give them a wide berth. It knew which foods tasted good, which women were attractive, and which colleagues had a problem with body odor. And it seemed, generally speaking, to know right from wrong. Jared's brain, you could say, was his best friend, which is what made it so hard to hear that his brain had a high-grade glioblastoma multiforme, or what would have made it hard had Jared known what that was. A glio what? He asked. The doctor, a gray-haired woman with a square jaw and white sandals, like Jared's Aunt Eva used to wear, looked at him for a long moment. I'm sorry, Jared. It's a brain tumor. He let the words roll around his brain. I'm sorry, Jared. It's a brain tumor. Was she sorry that it was a tumor, or sorry that she hadn't made herself clear when she used the term high-grade glioblastoma multiforme? Was the part of his brain that he was using at that very moment the part with the tumor? And, he asked, and it's not good news, the doctor answered. Not good news? Jared heard the words but was having trouble following the conversation. He knew he needed to focus, knew it was more important now than ever that he focus, but he just couldn't seem to do it. It was this intermittent lack of focus, these spells of confusion and memory loss, along with the persistent pain in his right temple, that had brought him to the neurologist in the first place. No, the doctor said. She waited for Jared to catch up. Not good news, he said, now understanding. It's inoperable. Inoperable, Jared repeated, this time understanding immediately. The only course of therapy I can prescribe is palliative. I'm sorry, doctor, I don't know that word. Though he didn't know if that had always been true, or if he had once known the word and had forgotten it. It means we can try to alleviate your suffering, but we can't do anything about the growth. It's going to stay. The growth is going to stay? Yes. He let this roll around his brain, too, and again wondered if the thought was rolling over, under, around, or through the tumor itself. Can I live with a tumor? He asked. The doctor let out a sigh. She hadn't meant to and stopped herself mid-breath. So it came out as a, and sounded more like a noise of agreement and sorrow. Then she said, no. No, Jared repeated. No, the doctor said. She delivered this news as a matter of fact, as if she were reporting the temperature and humidity, but Jared could see her eyes welling up, and he felt sorry for her. Empathy was central to his nature, or at least he thought he was. It was. He couldn't be sure of anything now. Stop there. And I'm not going to take any questions for Lynn, as I don't know how he would answer them. Next, Sarah Jade Allen will read from her young adult novel, A Messy, Beautiful Life. Sarah has performed in more than 1,000 improvised and scripted shows. when she isn't writing or performing. She teaches writing workshops as a faculty member of Lighthouse Writers Workshop's Youth Writers Program. Raised in a suburb of Chicago, she now lives in Colorado with her husband and daughter. Life is funny sometimes, and not always the ha-ha kind. Like that one time where a cute guy tried to kiss Ellie and she fell down, hard, and then she found out she had cancer. She's trying to be strong for her friends and her mom, and she's trying to be just friends with that cute guy, even though he seems to want much more. But she won't do that to him. He's been through this before with his own family, and she's not going to let him watch her die. So Ellie tells herself, smile, Ellie. Be funny, Ellie. Don't cry, Ellie. Because when she starts, she might not stop.
Thank you. And yeah, I'd like to add my thanks to Colorado Humanities and all the organizers and volunteers and to Book Bar. So thanks. Let me get this right. There. Can you hear me okay? So, really uplifting topics for the young adult category tonight. Double cancer, you're welcome. So I'm going to be reading from the first chapter, and the story of Messy Beautiful Life is about a girl named Ellie who is co-captain of her high school's improv comedy group. And she faces this heartbreaking diagnosis, and she decides to cope with it by entering a comedy contest and falling in love. As most people do. So this is going to be starting from the first chapter, a little ways in, where she and her friends Hannah and Quinn and their whole improv group have been invited over to a neighboring high school's improv show, and the show is about to start. The lights in the theater dimmed as the music swelled. Over the music, a guy in the sound booth announced our group. Welcome to Porter Township High School's Friday Night Comedy Mashup. Please put your hands together and welcome our guests for the evening, North Glen High's Spontaneous Combustion. As the red curtains parted, I could practically feel our collective stomach split. Hannah gave our group's standard spiel. Tonight we'll be doing a short-form style of improv similar to the TV show Whose Line Is It Anyway? We'll get suggestions from you in the audience and create instant scenes based on your suggestions. Are you ready? The audience cheered and we launched into our first scene. Our show clicked along as we played our favorite games of Arms Expert, Broadway Musical, and Replay. Hannah and I traded off between emceeing, playing, and guiding our team from the wings. Toward the end of our 30-minute set, we started our last game and invited Scared Scriptless to play with us. In the game of Freeze, two players do a scene until someone on the sideline yells, Freeze! Then the players have to hold whatever pose they were in. Another actor tags one person out, takes on the same position, but starts an entirely new scene that justifies that starting position. It continues as people call out freeze and start new scene after new scene. At one point, I was on stage with Chris, a massive guy who used to be on the football team. He was carrying me around, completely tipped on my side, as he shouted about finding the lost statue, when someone from Scared Scriptless yelled, freeze. A boy from the other team ran up to tag one of us out, which meant I would soon either have to hold a stranger or be held by a stranger. Fantastic. The poor boy was thin, but through his navy blue t-shirt that read Scared Scriptless in bold font, his chest and shoulders had a nice amount of oomph. Before I got a good look at his face, he disappeared behind me. He tagged Chris out. They exchanged thoughts while I tried to hold my statue pose on my side with one hand on my hip and one hand under my head, elbows out. Chris's large forearm left my waist, and was replaced by a tan, leaner version. This wrist sported one of those wristbands for a cause, which nestled up to, well, I'd have to describe it as the sexiest watch I'd ever seen, which was odd since I'd never considered them sexy before. In fact, I was pretty sure I'd never used the word sexy to describe anything, except while being sarcastic, like when Hannah jokingly made out with her pudding cup at lunch and had brown goop all around her mouth, I said, real sexy, Hannah. As the boys continued to shift my weight for the pass, I let myself dwell on Porter Boy's watch, the thickness of the black leather band, the shininess of the silver face. The word manly came to mind. His thumb ever so slightly grazed the bottom of my left breast, sorry, family's in the house, as he took complete hold of me. Fortunately, I didn't have time to worry about it because he had started the scene. Even though Porter Boy had proven he was confident physically carrying me, his character pretended to be awkward and shifted me back and forth while stuttering and umming. The experienced improviser me pushed past the freak out all his touching was causing and reacted to his offer. I wiggled out of his clutches and we faced each other, our eyes connecting for a second. His were a pleasing shade of brown, earthy but bright. When our gaze broke, the coolest thing happened. We both started doing the same thing at the same time. We brushing each other off and saying things like, "Ooh, sorry, oh, excuse me." We entered into some abstract game with each other. Turning him around so his back was to me, I tapped him between his shoulder blades, and as if reading my mind, he immediately fell back in my arms. I didn't know why I needed him to do that or how he knew how to do it, just that that's what had to happen next in our weird little game. I easily caught him and dragged him backwards. Our characters were in some alternate universe where they had to get somewhere, but only one person could do the transporting at a time. Sure, it made no sense whatsoever, but that was the glory of improv. And the audience loved it. Despite the bizarreness, Porter Boy and I were so committed that every new position, me getting a piggyback ride, him on my back like I was a horse, caused the audience to laugh harder. Porter Boy pretended to come upon a stream. He mimed testing the water and then lay down the imaginary stream and patted his chest, signaling me to climb on top of him. I gathered I was supposed to lie on top of him like he was a raft, so that's what I did. I putting my hands on either side of his shoulders, I lowered myself down like I was doing a slow push-up. His breath, so much heat, the swish, rush, thump of his blood through his heart. Then reality hit. From the outside, it must have looked like a weird improv girl about to lie right on top of a strange boy, on stage, in front of almost 200 people. We had been doing mere acrobatics for the past 2 minutes. Snippets popped into my mind. Entangled arms, wrapped legs, arched backs. My brain processed the building energy of the audience, the rising laughter, the hoots and whistles, and I realized our scene must have looked like an epic dry-humping session. Mortification enveloped me, like all the naked, peeing nightmares of childhood, but without the happy escape of waking. I feared this might be one of those shuddery life moments to etch a forever home on my memory's instant cringe list. And yet, the rare connection, the out-of-bodiness. I understood what it felt like to be in the moment. I also knew there was in the moment, you know, focused but aware, and really in the moment where everything outside the scene slipped away. It was what I read about in all our improv books, like some holy grail of improvisation. But I hadn't known it was possible to totally lose your mind and be completely in the moment. Now I did. And it was fun. If only it could have happened in private. But it hadn't. And we were still in it. I was hovering perilously close to his face. All this flashback processed in the embarrassment quadrant of my brain in an instant. I made the mistake of looking him in the eyes. Our faces were so close. His lips formed a shy grin on one side, revealing a single irresistible dimple. We cracked up, and I released the rest of my weight onto him in a fit of nervous laughter, my head falling in between the crook of his neck and shoulder. My nose informed me I had a new favorite smell. As he brushed off some of my hair that had fallen in his face, his arm mashed against me in a nice and only slightly suffocating kind of way. And he shouted, "Will someone please yell freeze already?" Someone from the audience yelled, "No, we're waiting for you to do it!" Yeah, the whole audience agreed in unison, and then they chanted, "Do it, do it, do it." Oh my God, it hit me that I was in fact still laying on top of him. Super speedily, I stopped sniffing him like some crazed wildebeest and jumped up, only to be left standing downstage, caught and bewildered, a flush of embarrassment crying out like a face tattoo. I decided I should really quit improv. It would make life so much easier. Thank you. Do you have any questions? No?
I have a question.
Oh, yeah.
Does anyone else?
I have a question. I was impressed with your use of an actual location, an actual school. Do you have any experiencing movies and music, actual school names, or do you
think that? Well, it was made up kind of a mash of from like where I grew up. I guess it is one in Colorado, but this takes place in Chicago, so I didn't really put it together. But
yeah.
So no, I haven't difficulty with that. But, yeah. Are you going to ask the question?
Yeah, I was going to ask that. Obviously, you have a background in improv.
Mm-hmm.
Did you do script writing for that? Is that what segued into writing a novel, or was it just another area of interest?
Oh, good question. Yeah, I actually, didn't start out as a fiction writer. I started out in improv and stand-up and sketch comedy years ago, and I ended up working in New York City, working for an author of best-selling young adult novels as her assistant, my job, right after college. And so I got introduced to the world of young adult literature, and it had changed so much since when I was a kid, and I just, fell in love with it. And then I also got to interact with all of her amazing fans and knew what a wonderful audience it was. So this book is semi-autobiographical in that I did have a rare bone cancer when I was in my 20s. And so when I got that diagnosis, I was on crutches for a year, and suddenly performing improv was a lot harder. And so this idea came to mind of a boy and girl on stage in a scene. It was a dream I woke up from, and I was like, I want to see where that goes. And so I just started writing it, and it turned into a novel. That's the long answer.
Too long.